Coming up next, we got Amina El Hassan with our plotline predictions for the upcoming NBA season, and then Warren Sharp reviewing this week in the NFL. All right, today we're going to predict the NBA plot lines for the 25-26 season with Amin El Hassan. Amin, how you doing today?
What's up, KLC? What's going on, man?
I'm doing great, man. I'm looking forward to the season. We got preseason games starting up now, but I want to look ahead to opening night and the season ahead. What are the stories going to be? What are the things that fans are going to be talking about the most? What are we going to be talking about on our podcast throughout the year? So I want to start off with you. We're going to go back and forth with four each. Some plot lines that are going to be stories this year. I mean, what's your first one?
What's going to happen with the Clippers? Like this can't be anything other than number one on everyone's agenda, because this has real implications that go far beyond opening week, opening night, or whatever. This could not only impact this season for the Clippers, but perhaps the next few, four, five, six seasons. You know, if the league comes down with the type of judgment that is within its purview, you're talking about something that could set this franchise back for quite a while.
Absolutely could, and no doubt about it. And they're already in a position where they don't have any picks until I believe 2030. And So if those picks were to be taken away in the distant future, if they were to trade those picks, as Tom Haverstraw said, maybe they should try to trade them. They could take away picks after the 7-year rule, you know? They could go even deeper to try to really punish the Clippers. And I mean, ultimately, man, it's going to be fascinating just to see what route the NBA does go here, because everything you've done, you know, on Pablo's show, great job, by the way, with how you guys have handled it. Thanks. It seems like it's been a lot of fun seeing that information, flipping those papers over. It seems like this is enough based off of the rules of the collective bargaining agreement. The circumstantial evidence is pretty unexplainable, right? But does the NBA just want to sweep this under the rug because they know, maybe they know there's other teams that have done this and it opens up a can of worms that they don't want to do?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, a lot of people, these nuts about the Constitution, always say, oh, the framers, they knew back then and they predicted all these problems. Like, could they really? Whoever the lawyers that wrote Article 13 of the collective bargaining agreement that I feel like I'm in a common law relationship with at this point, I've read Article 13 so many times. It is so good. They figured out everything, every little angle. They got it. It's like, if this happens. And so the two parts that I keep coming back to is one clause that says services rendered, fair market value for services rendered for a third party, right? That's one. And two is, you mentioned it, is there a rational explanation? Circumstantial evidence that cannot be rationally explained other than there's cap circumvention going on. Those two parts right there seem to be the thing that make this an open and shut case. But as you said, I don't know. There are other political pressures to it. I quote the late, great Jerry Tarkanian. He said, the NCAA was so mad at Kentucky, they decided to hit Fresno State with another sanction, right? Like the idea that, like, yeah, these rules apply, but only for certain people. And the thing that complicates the story, obviously, more than anything, Kevin, is that Steve Ballmer seems to be a very well-liked and respected guy by a lot of people. I've said this a bunch of times. If this were Jim Dolan, if this were the Knicks, they would have thrown the kitchen sink at him. I think it would have been... It would be a swift and unequivocal adjudication. But because I think people like Steve Ballmer, and all, obviously he represents a massive amount of wealth and power, they kind of don't want to see the book being thrown at a guy who seems to be like a pretty cool guy, all things considered.
For sure. I mean, but you have to do it, though, if there is enough to show that this guy and the people around him did indeed what it seems like that they did. And ultimately, for the Clippers, this being part of the story, A, because it could deter other teams from doing it if they do punish them, or it could influence other teams to say, well, they got a little slap on the wrist, we're going to decide to do this. And then for the immediate future, from a pure basketball standpoint, how does this affect a team that has championship aspirations? Will it be something looming over the team? Will it be something that if it's a penalty involving Kawhi, that it removes him from the team, suspends him from the team? Or do the Clippers actually exist as a contender in this immediate season? Never mind all the long-term stuff. There are implications for this particular season and the teams in the West that are trying to make the playoffs. And any amount of time any player misses due to injury, suspension, or whatever else could be the difference between making the playoffs, being in the play-in, or just being in the lottery. And so in the short term, there's big implications here too.
Well, and the interesting thing we've been talking about all along is the joke is, oh, it would be doing the Clippers a favor if they voided Kawhi Leonard's contract.
That's ridiculous.
Well, the idea is that because he hasn't been available, right? And how big would the uproar be if Kawhi Leonard had been healthy and available and the Clippers had been winning a lot more games and going deep in the playoffs and maybe even a championship? Would the outrage and uproar be louder if that were the case? Clearly, he wasn't any of those things. And so we don't have that. That's a hypothetical. But here's the part that's not a hypothetical. He's healthy now for the first time in a very long time. What if he's awesome right now? What if the Clippers are the number one seed? Then what happens to the conversation? It goes, whatever. Like they paid all this money for the injured guy. Now, all of a sudden, if he's playing the way that we know he's capable of playing and the Clippers are winning, how does that flip the conversation? Like, wait a second, they cheated and they shouldn't be able and all that stuff. In the meantime, as the investigation goes on.
Do you think the Clippers have a chance to be that good?
I do. Look, they certainly have went old, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris Paul, you had Bradley Beal. You're kind of pushing your chips to the middle of the table of, hey, give me guys that were drafted between 2005 and 2010, right? But the reality is, when healthy, and I know that's a big if, but it's like, when healthy? Like, this has a very full roster. They went out and they added John Collins as I said, Beal and Paul, and it's like, it's a lot more full of a roster. They're diverse. They can defend. We know they're tough as hell, right? They're well coached. And they've got a guy in Kawhi Leonard who, like, again, the question is never his basketball ability. It's his availability. So when he's out there, he is one of the single most destructive offensive forces we have in the game. You put it all together and you say, oh, and look, this is a team that came within a seventh game of beating Denver, who came within, however close of beaten Minnesota, right? Like, so there's a lot, like you said it yourself, the margin of error in the Western Conference is very small. So it doesn't really take a massive effort if you're good enough, and I think the Clippers are good enough. All you really need is some bad luck breaking the other way, like what happened to Denver in the second round last year with Aaron Gordon getting hurt. It's like, all you really need is that, and that creates a separation. I said Minnesota. They played Oklahoma City in the second round. I'm tripping, but the point.
In 2025, they lost to Denver, and 2024 lost to Dallas. I'm just going back year by year. Yep. And 23 lost to Phoenix. 2022, they did not make the playoffs. 2021, they lost to the Denver. Western Conference Finals to the Suns. So
the Suns,
I mean,
yeah.
Fallen short a bunch of times, but like a lot of like competitive teams. And I think, on paper, I love their front court versatility. I think there's a lot there that's interesting. And despite the age of the team, to me, it's not about age as much as it's about health with them. And ultimately, this whole Clippers situation, that is going to be something that looms and that we don't stop talking about until the NBA makes a decision. And if they do, it could have a significant effect for this season itself. Do you have any plans of recording with Pablo again anytime soon?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Okay. Not at liberty to say. Let's move on to number two, my first one here. What heights does Victor Wembanyama reach? We saw their inter-squad scrimmage with him just plowing through Luke Kornet on transition. Looked like Giannis Antetokounmpo. We have Victor Wembanyama saying he worked harder than anybody this offseason. He was, of course, training with Bonks. He spent time with KG, among others. And I mean, look, I think with Victor, he already is an unbelievable talent, but he very clearly has little things that he can get better at that aren't actually so little. They're actually pretty important. Last year, as an isolation scorer, he was only in the 17th percentile according to Synergy, shot only 33% out of isolations, We know how much he shoots three-pointers, but with the Spurs situation, a lot of non-shooters or below-average shooters on the team, how effectively are they going to be able to get Victor at the rim at an even more increased rate than he already can? And so as much as you like the Fox fit and the Harper fit and Castle after his great rookie season, how do those guys fit with Victor? And Fox might miss the beginning of the season as well. So with Victor, does he become like a top five player in the NBA this season, or he's still more in that top 10, top 15 range? And what did the Spurs look like around him? To me, that is one of the bigger stories of this year ahead.
Yeah. Top five might be a little bit of a stretch. I mean, there's some really good players in this league. So uh-huh. Top five, it might be a bit soon, but
you saw ESPN put him at five on their top 100 list. I'm the dude. I had Victor top 10, I think before anybody. And people told me it was too soon. It wasn't. I don't think it was too soon. Top five, boy, it's a little too soon for top five.
I think sometimes we conflate where someone's going with where they are. He's going to be there for sure. Yes. He's not there yet. I don't think. Again, there are some great players who are still playing right now, right? You want to say top five, we're talking about the MVPs, right? Like, talking about Jokic, we're talking about SGA, we're talking about Giannis, right? That's three already, so... And then, you know, is he better than Steph? I don't think he's better than Steph. So I throw Steph there. And then is he better than Luka? I don't think he's better than Luka right now.
Not yet.
Luka.
No.
And so, that's just me off the top of my head. Like, I go roster by roster. I don't think he's better than this guy, whatever. But we see it. It's happening, right? Like, because the train's arriving in the station on time. And the weight gain, the strength gain, so the core strength is big. I remember this with Brandon Ingram. Came in the league and was really skinny and struggled his rookie year. And I remember saying, like, he knows what to do. He's not soft. It's just he's physically not strong enough. He's playing against grown men. And the biggest thing is not him putting on a bunch of muscle or whatever, but it's core strength. It's the ability to run, come shoulder to shoulder off a screen and not get shoved far off course because I don't have the core strength to hold my ground, so to speak. So he did that. He's always been really incredibly flexible, which is good, and I think that's going to help for injury prevention. And then you talked about working with KG, working with Hakeem. Like, he's got all this other skill stuff that, like you said, he needs to get better at. He needs to be more efficient. But then the next part of this is, who's coming with me, right? So Fox being out, that's a problem because, again, they didn't play a whole lot last year either because of injuries. So how can we get them on the same page so that they have a chemistry that's being built, right? And then Dylan Harper and Castle and everyone else kind of getting where they fit in. And how can we now transition from last year, which is we're scrappy, but the expectation is we're not going to win games, to now, no, these possessions matter. We're not just rolling the ball out. We're not just letting him figure things out as they did for his first 2 years. Now he has to learn how to be judicious with his touches and his impact in the game.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's been, you know, Victor's missed time as well. Popovich, of course, unfortunately, has moved to the front office after his health scare last year. Mitch Johnson, middle of the season. What does he look like as a head coach installing his stuff? Is it copy and paste what Pop's done? And, you know, I think ultimately this roster needs to come around. I mean, Dylan Harper needs to prove he can shoot. Castle needs to get better as a shooter. Fox and Wemby were not great together in the very tiny sample last year. What did they look like over the course of the season as well? And all of that's going to directly impact how Victor looks and then therefore how the Spurs look as a team. What's your next one, Amin?
Oh, okay. So my next one is what I affectionately have been calling the Olden State Warriors. what happens next, right? The Kuminga was this thing that hung over their entire offseason. It delayed the signings of Al Horford and DeAnthony Melton. They finally got him, 2-year deal, team option on the second year. For a Golden State, a very important victory in terms of how this contract is structured, because basically this deal is made to move, right? I think everyone recognizes Jonathan Kuminga does not fit the way Golden State wants to play unless Golden State's desperate because a bunch of people got hurt. Right, that's basically been his storyline. And so the talent is there. You give him a contract that compensates him appropriately, I think, in the short term. But at the same time, isn't this massive thing that anyone else down the line who wants to acquire him has to deal with three more years of this or whatever. So in a very real way, Jonathan Kuminga is not even in their plans, I don't think, for this season. I think this is a guy that's, again, priced to move January 15th as soon as he's eligible to get traded. I think they're going to go and try and get more depth and more kind of weapons in their arsenal for a team that, as we said, is pretty old. You talk about Steph Curry, Jimmy Butler, Al Horford, Draymond Green. These guys hold 34, 35 and up. That's a lot of old dudes that you're counting on, in essence. And so they've got to get some more that weird in between young vet, like not too young to not understand how the game was played, but not too old to where now we're dealing with your injury issues as well.
So with them, you mentioned going to get pieces. Do you think the Warriors are more likely to like combine salaries, like Kuminga at 22.5 plus Hield plus Moody for like a star type player making 40 plus million, or is it more like they're angling for like a Trey Murphy, somebody like that, or multiple pieces? Like, what way are you going for the Warriors?
I think option B. I think your stars are your stars. You got Jimmy Butler, who's an incredible possession type offensive talent. Like, hey, we need one. Get you down there, get some free throws, get something around the basket. You got Steph Curry, who goes without saying what he is. I think you're good on the stardom.
So, like, so no Lowry Markkanen. You're knocking him off your list. No Lowry.
To me, I think traditionally Golden State has been successful. If you look at their championship years, having a bunch of really smart dudes, guys who have been in the league, they know how to play. They're over the politics of, hey, man, I can't believe I'm not starting. Like, no, I get it. I'm here to help this team win. That's what makes them. Going back to even with Durant, like everyone kept, yes, obviously Durant, Klay Thompson, and Steph Curry together is a minor, right? But the part where they killed you for real was they'd roll out David West and Sean Livingston. And like all of these just savvy, shrewd dudes, they were way better than your 6, 7, 8 guy. Everyone on the Warriors was just a smart player who knew how to play, right? The last championship, Bielitsa and Gary Payton, right? And like all these guys were just, they knew how to play. They knew what they were doing out there. And I think that's what this team needs to go back to. You can't rely on, as well as they play, Brandon Pajemski and Quentin Post and all that. Like, you can't rely on young guys like that in the playoffs. You need guys that are a little bit more experienced. And if those guys come along, that's great. But you can't just say, oh, we're good. We're satisfied in that area. I think they're stars. You're good. You check the boxes. You're good on stardom. Now it's about building a complete team.
Interesting. I mean, I haven't thought a lot about like that, the side you're detailing for the Warriors, because they have a lot of like guys. Like if you look at their depth chart, I mean, yeah, like there's going to be solid players. Santos might not get minutes. Like Seth Curry might not get minutes. De'Anthony Melton might not get minutes every night. Those are solid players. Right. I mean, like it's the guys who are coming off the bench. It might be Pods. It might be Hield. It might be Moody. But to your point, you're kind of proposing splitting up Kuminga into multiple pieces rather than trading Kuminga with 3, 4, however many future picks, maybe another young guy, a Moody or a Pods, to go get somebody else. Because like I've been thinking a lot about guys like, you know, Trey Murphy, who would cost a lot from the Pelicans. Yep. I've been thinking about like, what if Drew Holiday became available from the Blazers? Somebody like that, like stacking pieces together to go get somebody who's more expensive, you know, like a Kobe White, you know, something like that from Chicago. Just some of these names that are popping up. Or, you know, what if the Pelicans say, yeah, we will trade Zion? You know, like a home run swing piece like that. Now, those are some of the names I've been thinking about for the Warriors. But you're thinking about kind of still supporting those older guys with depth pieces aside from Kuminga, who fit.
I think when you look at their payroll, right, where they're at, they're, and this is after years and years of being massive taxpayers, they're in a really strong place financially. And so not quite, you know, not quite in the second apron, but like it's doable. It's workable. If you end up with another big salary, I feel like we saw this with the Lakers, you get handcuffed, right? If you do this one more move and it's like big money Steph, big money Jimmy Butler, big money this new person, and then Draymond Green, not quite the big money, but still large enough. Now you're locked in. It's like, you want to get better? Too bad. You better get used to the minimum salary bin. And that isn't a fun place to be. We've seen this a bunch of times.
That is why I like Trey Murphy, though. I mean, because he started year one of a 4-year contract where year four, he's going to be making $31 million. Like that's the one name. I think with Markkanen, like that's a big money deal. But like Trey Murphy, you get 4 years of runway where it's like, okay, that one makes sense.
To me, Trey Murphy kind of fits. I know it's more of a one-to-one salary move, but it's like that fits what I'm talking about. This is a young vet. He's smart. He knows how to play, and he's appropriately compensated. And we can fit him in and keep this thing moving.
Dude, he would become a star if he got traded to the Warriors. It would just be a perfect seamless fit for what that would happen. I agree with you. Like, I think that's going to be one of the bigger stories, because I do think the Warriors, as good as they are on paper, they're still a move away, and upgrading Kuminga is the obvious route there. Right. Moving on to my second one here, number four total. The Knicks offense, they hire Mike Brown as head coach. We see them play their first couple of preseason games, more motion, more movement, a ton more handoffs than we've seen from more of those stagnant Thibodeau offenses, running a lot of Brunson pick and roll, ISOs, whatnot, over and over and over. Seems like they're going to play with more pace. Seems like they're going to play with more motion. I'm sure it's going to be an adjustment period for the Knicks. I wonder, how quickly do they adjust? Does this team fully embrace playing that way? Is there a steep learning curve for a guy, especially like Brunson, after playing a certain way and shining a certain way? How does this affect their defense? You know, playing more, you know, with more effort and energy and intensity on offense, does that make their defense worse? A lot of questions on my mind with the Knicks. I think ultimately, though, Mike Brown was the right choice with this type of offense he sort of envisions for Brunson and Cat and Bridges and Ananobi. But that's no guarantee ultimately to work.
Yeah, I also was really high on that Mike Brown hiring. I thought he's the guy that checked all the boxes as far as like credentialed and obviously had been. To me, it was really big that the guy who's coaching the Knicks has to be someone who's been through some fire. And whether it's coaching LeBron or coaching the Lakers, right? It's like Mike Brown has been in like the hottest of hells of media attention and all that stuff. So coming to New York isn't exactly going to be this brand new culture shock thing for him. Offensively, obviously, he's grown a lot over the years. He credits a lot of it to his time as on the staff with the Golden State Warriors, kind of opening his mind. Obviously, we saw what he did in Sacramento at the time, the best offense in NBA history. Obviously, we just shatter that mark every single year now. But he's got that. But again, his bones are defensive guy, right? That's how he made a name for himself in this league. And so that's the part I'm more interested in. I like the motion offense. I think it's going to be good for everybody, including Brunson, because as we've seen time and time again throughout NBA history, whether it's Michael Jordan, whether it's Steph Curry, whatever, it's like, yeah, the easy thing is just to give him the ball and get the hell out of the way. But there's a cap to how good you can be. And also that takes a toll on you. And playing off ball frees you up a lot more and gives you more energy, I feel like, because it's not everything is just zeroed in on you. But the defense is the part where I'm wondering, because Tom Thibodeau wasn't a slouch defensively, and that Knicks team did not defend, namely because two of your starting five are guys who are minus defenders, Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns. And so what is Mike Brown going to do in order to adjust all that to make that better? I know they started Mitchell Robinson in the preseason game over.
Do you like that decision? Do you think that's a positive for their defense?
I think that is the first solution you go to. I don't think that's the last solution, but you have to start with that one. Because anything else, now you lost Mitchell Robinson. Mitchell Robinson sitting there and saying, better defensive. There you go. That's my cue, right? If you went any other direction, but man, you lose a guy. So you have to start with, we're starting Mitchell Robinson. Will it work? On some nights, yes. On some nights, no. But you have to start there, and as you make your tweaks. But the other thing I said, you have to demand more of your guys, specifically Karl Anthony Towns. You have to demand more of him. Like, he's not a bad defender because he's Dirk slow, right? He's a bad defender because he makes bad decisions. A lot. And so that, I think he's at a point, and especially where this team is, championship contention is what they hope. you're at a point where it's like, hey, man, we need more. Whatever it is, whatever your level of like, I'm doing it, coach, it's not enough. We need more out of you. And I think, again, Mike Brown is a guy that can demand, but maybe not over the top demand like, you know, how Tibbs would have been.
I mean, I think ultimately starting Mitch makes sense. And to your point about Cat, he makes a lot of poor decisions defensively. He made better decisions when he was playing next to Rudy Gobert, not just because Gobert is helping clean up for mistakes, but also I think Cat was in a position where he probably felt more comfortable defending a bit more on the perimeter, being a bit more of a help guy rather than being the primary guy in drop coverage like Gobert so often was. And even if he was, he still had that assistance behind him with that level of a rim protector. And Mitchell Robinson is not a Rudy Gobert level rim protector, but he's better than having a bunch of small guys and help behind you and where it's all on you. And so I think that move, to me, that's one of the things that still surprises me the most about last season with the Knicks. I know Mitchell Robinson missed a lot of time, but the fact that we didn't see two bigs as an experiment with any of the other Knicks bigs, like Jericho Sims before he got traded, we barely saw it with Cat. Ariella Hekporty, who had some good minutes, you know, deep bench minutes, barely saw him at all with Cat. And so I think like Tibbs missed opportunities during the season to play with two bigs. And then it's like, oh, damn, like we got to try this during the postseason because nothing else is working. And it worked. Like it looked pretty good with Mitch and Cat out there. And I think it makes sense to go with that first for their defense and for their offense. We'll see how that fits as well. For playing through both of those guys a lot in the post, Mitchell Robinson, of course, more of a high screen and roll guy, you know, dive to the basket. We'll see how he adapts in that system as well. All right, before we move on to Amin's next one, we're doing a mailbag episode on Thursday. So if you're listening on Spotify, please leave a comment below with a thought, a question, a prediction, a take, whatever it is, and I'll answer it on Thursday's episode. We're going to answer all your mailbag questions about the season ahead, or you can at me on social, at Kevin O'Connor on X, Instagram, TikTok, Threads. Send it wherever. I'll find it. Message me there, or you can email me at kocshow@yahoosports.com and send all your stuff there, and we'll answer it on Thursday's mailbag episode. We'll be back in a second. What do you have next, I mean, for your third one?
All right. My third one is how the Houston Rockets adapt post Van Vliet injury. And so, you know, before the recent events, we kind of looked at the Western Conferences. OKC, Denver, and Houston. And then there's a gap. And then there's the next little group with the Clippers and the Lakers and the Warriors, whoever. And then Van Vliet gets hurt. And the important thing to realize here is that the Rockets are pretty much hard capped, right? They can't just, oh, we'll just go out and get someone else. Like even signing someone to a minimum deal. I'm looking up how much breathing room they have. Yeah. They have 1.25 million. So you can't even sign anyone at minimum at this point. So they have to basically wait till prorated season. So I started thinking about, well, if you're the Rockets and you think, man, our window is right now. Is there a Van Vliet deal out there? Is there someone you can go get? For instance, you mentioned Jrue Holiday. Can I pick up the phone and call Portland and say, I got a bunch of extra. Just the idea of like, you got to go out in there and get somebody because the window is now. Or do you say, no, I like who we've got. I think Reed Sheppard is going to be amazing. And you take your chances. But then I go back to kind of like, do you really want your championship season to be decided by combination of Reed Sheppard and Aaron Holiday? It feels like that's too big of an exhaust port on your internet, your space station that destroys planets, right? Like, it's a little too risky there. And so you want something with a little bit more reliability, dependability, especially when we talk about postseason.
I do think this is absolutely going to be a thing for sure with the Rockets this year. Like, to me, the thing that makes sense to do is you start the season with Reed Sheppard, Amen Thompson, put the ball in their hands, let them see what they have, let them develop, let them go through growing pains. And as long as you're not losing too many games, like if you're losing games and you're the seventh seed, and again, the West is so stacked, these games are going to matter. Like seeding will matter. You don't want to experiment too much at this, because then you're in the play-in. But ultimately, I do think you need to give those guys time and see what you have in them. Does Amen Thompson get a little bit better as a shooter? Like, is he a liability when he runs point? Does Reed Sheppard look more like he did post his G League success? He had some big scoring games against OKC, among other teams, in the second half of the year. Does he carry that forward this season and start looking like the guy where you're not even thinking about making any moves? Maybe Reed Sheppard is your guy and he's one of those rare young point guards. Like, I remember when Rajon Rondo, second year with the Boston Celtics, KG, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, that 07-08 Celtics team. The question with that team was, well, can Rondo be the point guard? You know, right. And he turned out he could be the point guard because he did the things that team needed. Maybe Reed Sheppard can be that guy in year two of his NBA career, but maybe not. I think you have to find that out early in the year as the Rockets, and then that conversation will really come with them. Do they need to make a move? Who do they go for? And even if Reed Sheppard's really good, I mean, I love the idea of Drew Holiday. Like, if you're able to get Fred VanVleet to waive that no trade clause on his $25 million salary, like, please, that would be awesome to get a Drew Holiday.
I think it's one of those things where you owe it to yourself. If you're the Rockets, you have to explore every single opportunity. It's so easy. People's like, oh, well, we'll get him next year. Like, no, man, like, that's not how this thing works. Because next year is next year, and you never know what might be the next thing around the corner. So I think you got to be aggressive. And if you're Fred VanVleet, I mean, there's worse places to go than Portland, I guess. I feel like if you're hurt for the year, doesn't matter. Like, I won't even report. I'll stay at home, and then, you know, I'll inform them, hey, you better be ready to flip me because I'm not going to stay, pretty much. So I think when you think about kind of this situation Houston's in, and I want to go back to what you were saying about, like, Thompson. Absolutely, that's the play. You put the ball in his hands, and then you kind of spread out from there. And then you hope Şengün can find his way, and obviously KD is KD or whatever. But the Sheppard part, the Reed Sheppard part, is like the next layer. It's like, okay, I'm going to get 20 minutes out of this position a night, right, with the current makeup. Is it going to be Reed Sheppard or is it going to be Aaron Holiday? And if it's Reed Sheppard, does Reed Sheppard defend to the liking of Ime Udoka, right? Because he's really big on that. He wants everyone he wants this defense to be physical and constant. And so does Reed Sheppard have that in him as far as, hey, I'm going to spend a lot of energy chasing people around being a pest, and maybe not as much. And I think that's the part where I get trepidatious, because I look at Reed Sheppard and say, well, what's his thing? Thank you. I've been doing Pablo Torre Finds Out. I look at Reed Sheppard and say, what's his thing? His thing is offense, is scoring, whatever, right? What do the Rockets need? Probably not that. They need someone who's going to keep this thing moving, make shots when called upon, and defend their position. And it's like, that doesn't really describe him today. Now,
maybe. I mean,
can he grow into that?
Can he transform into it? Because he is a defensive playmaker. He had a ton of blocks at Kentucky on 3-point shooters and steals and spark. I know it's college, but like,
everyone's got a scrapbook. Everyone has a scrapbook.
Super scrappy. Like, maybe he can transform into that. But I think, to your point, though, that is the question with him. Can he survive defensively? Or because he's so small, he's going to be the defender every time he's on the floor, considering all the other length and versatility the Rockets have out there. They're going to attack Reed Sheppard no matter how quality he is or not. He's going to be the attack point. Can he survive? Whereas with Amen Thompson, he's one of the best defenders in the NBA already. You're not going to attack him, but you're losing something with shooting when Amen Thompson is out there. So it's about finding the right balance. I mean, ultimately, I think there's a chance this ends up a blessing in disguise that VanVleet is out, because you get to see these young guys. You're just ripping the Band-Aid off. You're going to find out what you have in these young guys and figure out what you really need. Because VanVleet has had his limitations, man. Like, he wasn't a perfect point guard. I don't think he was the perfect point guard for this team either. I really don't.
Right.
I think he had his limitations. He was just kind of the placeholder to me, while hoping Amen or Reed Sheppard become that. at some point. But this undoubtedly, I mean, behind Oklahoma City, behind Denver, those two teams, I think, are clearly the top of the top in the Western Conference. And that'll lead me to my next one here with the Denver Nuggets. Which version of Jamal Murray does Denver get? Do they get that 2023 finals run version of Jamal Murray where he's in shape, he's bringing it consistently? During that run, he averaged 26 points per game on nearly 60% true shooting. Or do they get the guy who comes into the season a bit out of shape, up and down, extremely inconsistent? In his past two postseasons, he averaged only 21.2 points per game, only 51.6% true shooting. Do they get that version of Jamal Murray where you don't really know what you're going to get? Or do they get that version of Jamal that helped vault them from nice playoff team to co-star for Jokic and ultimately an NBA championship? And that's where I think they can close the gap with OKC or even surpass OKC, depending on the version of Jamal Murray they get. Because I love everything else on that roster. It's just Jamal Murray I have big questions about.
Let me play a different game with you. Will it even matter? Will it even matter? And the reason I say that is, I think with what they did, going out and getting, first of all, Cam Johnson, who I think is infinitely more reliable and a better fit than Michael Porter Jr. for this team.
Agreed.
Bringing back Bruce Brown, bringing in Tim Hardaway Jr. Like, I think they kind of, I'm not saying they don't need Jamal Murray anymore, but they put themselves in a position where they need Jamal Murray to be this otherworldly playoff presence like he's been earlier in his career. You just got to be good. You got to show up a bunch of times, but not every time. And we've got enough. And I thought the irony, of course, of Michael Malone for the last couple of years complaining, you're not giving me enough. You're not giving me enough. You got to give me enough. And then they get him out of there. And the first thing they do is they go out and get all the stuff that he was pretty much asking for. But I think that playoffs really hit home for Josh Kroenke, right? Like, oh, we don't have enough because we switched coaches. And Coach Adelman was like, yeah, I'm not playing those dudes. I'm going to play six guys or whatever, and Aaron Gordon's going to fall apart before our eyes because I can't trust any of these guys. And so the new front office with Ben Tenzer, obviously, has been there the whole time, and John Wallace, who had been there but went to Minnesota with Tim
Connolly. Yep.
With Tim Connolly, yeah. So they went out and they rebuilt this thing. They gave Nikola Jokic and Coach Adelman the support they needed. And now Jamal Murray has less of a pressure to be amazing every single time. The other part of it, and it's going to sound like a cop-out, like, guy been hurt, right? Like, he's coming off of last summer playing for Canada. He wasn't healthy doing that. Then he started the year slow, and he hasn't been 100%. So I think that's part of why he's disappointed over the last year plus. But the bigger thing for me is they got horses now. And I didn't even mention Jonas Valanciunas, who that's the best backup Nikola Jokic has had basically.
Not
since,
even close.
Since
I mean.
Nurkic. Since yeah. Nurkic, right? Like, and when Nurkic was his backup, he wasn't obviously anything close to what he is now. So,
and also with Valanciunas, last year's first round pick, Daron Holmes out of Dayton, super versatile big man, can shoot threes. Like, if they didn't have Valanciunas, he might have been the best backup of Jokic's career, and he hasn't even played an NBA game yet.
But it's gonna be interesting to see how they're able to, I think, lighten the load not only on Murray but also on Jokic. It's like, I remember the game they played Washington, and like Jokic had like a 56-point triple double, and they lost that game. And all I could think to myself is, I don't know how much more like that guy. Like, if you lose to the Wizards at the time, the Wizards before they started playing better, so this is Jordan Poole's Wizards, right? Like, I had 56 and a triple double. Like, what more needs to happen for us to have a fighting chance to win a game? I thought that was just such a kind of snapshot of like, this can't go on forever. They've got to do something. And kudos to them. They went out and they did, I think, a little bit more than something. I think they did a lot.
Do you think the Nuggets are the favorite over the Thunder?
No.
No. Okay.
No, for two reasons. One is that's the defending champs. and nothing has changed for them, right? It's not like, oh, they're adding. They're doing the thing that won them a championship a year ago in 60 million games during the regular season, right? And two is, I think Denver still has, Cam Johnson hasn't been a particularly durable guy in his career. You mentioned Jamal Murray. Aaron Gordon obviously has dealt with injuries. So they still have things to worry about as far as, can we get everybody together and healthy and on the same page before we start talking about being the best team in the conference? But like I said earlier, when we list out the West, it's OKC, Denver, Houston, and then there's a gap, and then there's the next group after that.
What's your next one? I mean, your last of your four.
My last one is I don't know if this is something that's going to even be on the radar for NBA media people, let alone NBA fans, but the Suns Arena got renamed again. And so if you're keeping track at home, since 2020, since COVID, the Suns have played at Talking Stick Resort Arena, Phoenix Suns Arena, Footprint Center, PHX Arena, and now Mortgage Matchup Center. And the big the big reason, it's like, oh, yeah, well, another silly name. The difference is Mortgage Matchup Center, sure, whatever the naming rights deal is, whatever it is, but what people need to realize is the owner of Mortgage Matchup is Matt Ishbia. In essence, he's basically saying, how much is the naming rights deal? All right, $2 million. All right, there you go. Take it out of my right pocket, put it in my left pocket. Like, you're not making money here, right? It's just creative bookkeeping, in essence. And so that leads me down to, wait, is this the case because they couldn't sell? Like, they, whatever the number was, they couldn't get that number, and rather than devalue the product, so to speak, and cut the price, they just found, they artificially created a new buyer to come in and meet that price until someone can top it. Or the other rampant theory here locally is, right across from the arena, there's a massive billboard, Rocket Mortgage. Don't know who owns Rocket Mortgage. It's owned by Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, a proud son of Detroit like Matt Ishbia, and bitter rivals. These two people hate each other. They hate each other. They're from the same town. They're the two biggest mortgage brokers, basically, in the nation. And they both own NBA teams, and they hate each other. And so you got this huge billboard across the arena. It's like, this is bad. Look, we got to put an even bigger billboard. Mortgage Matchup right on the front.
First of all, I didn't even realize that the name changed again. I see that just happened 3 days ago. The news came out. Crazy it's happened again. I did not know about the billboard for Rocket Mortgage across the street from the arena. It makes sense that Ishbia would, you know, feel a certain way about this and decide, I'm just going to name it myself. But I do think it's worth looking into or finding out, Kevin, if there's just no sales.
This is like the billionaire's version of bottle wars. You know, like you go in, the guy's going to the club, like, 7 bottles, 18 bottles, 35 bottles. And they're like, oh, like, this is what they're doing. It's like, huh. It's like billboard, arena. What's next?
Or it's like when Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm got the Spite Store.
The Spite Store,
coffee shop. Latte Larry's.
Gotta have the scones, though. Good scones gotta be drunk.
Exactly. Could have been that, too. Let's move on to my final one here. How does the NBA media rights deal impact the fan experience? That, to me, is going to be definitely a thing with every game, every night. Some nights it's on Peacock. Sometimes it's on NBC on Sundays and Tuesdays. It's ESPN on Wednesdays. It's Amazon on this night and ABC on that night. It's different stations, different apps. How do fans adapt? How does this impact the game watching experience? Is the NBC broadcast amazing? Is it so great that it raises the bar for other broadcasts? Is that possible, or is it underwhelming? What's the Amazon broadcast like? It's just so much that we don't know with these broadcasts. Yeah. How is it going to impact the fans? How is it going to impact the league? Because I know maybe it was like 6 or 7 years ago when around after the last CBA was signed, somebody in the league office high up said to me, they said, we're not worried about this next rights deal. We're worried about the one after that. So 10 years from now, or however long until those negotiations begin with the next CBA, people in the league office have said for quite a while they were never worried about this one, and clearly they weren't, considering all the big money involved. Mm-hmm. But how does this rights deal, how does this broadcast deal impact the fan experience and therefore the bottom line for the NBA? It's definitely, I think, going to be one of the stories in the short term, and of course in the long term too.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the big failures of Adam Silver a few weeks ago when he was asked about that. He gave like this weird answer instead of just saying, hey, guess what? There are more free games now than there have been in the last 10 years. That's the answer. The answer is there's more. You don't have to subscribe or download anything. There's more free games available on national TV now than there have been in the past decade. That's number one. Now, if you're going to subscribe, now you've got even more. So whether it's Peacock, whether it's Amazon, like that's a dessert that you weren't planning on before you had the three courses. Now they've added the fourth course of dessert. So there's that. But the other thing is, I didn't even think about this, but as you said it, I realized I haven't been curious of what Amazon's coverage is going to look like. I kind of have an idea what ESPN's going to look like, but I just realized I have this internal expectation that NBC's has to be amazing. And I felt it as recently as last night. I'm watching Sunday Night Football, and as they're coming back from commercial break, you hear Round Ball Rock. It's like, the NBA is back on NBC. And you hear Mike Tirico even like really thrilled to talk. I'm like, oh, man. Yeah, NBA on NBC. And you know, the thing I've been saying is I hope they bring the entire retro package. I want a monologue before every game. I want, whether it's Bob Costas or whoever doing a voiceover, letting me know that this game isn't just a February Sunday game between two divisional rivals. This is for all the marbles in the universe and everything at stake, right? Those monologues did such a great job of marketing and selling our game. And I'm hoping NBC does not skimp on any of that. But for the fan experience, I imagine people just don't like change. And what they're complaining about is the change of having to look somewhere different for these games. But the reality is it's going to be better because we have more options available to everybody.
I think it's going to be better too. I hope for fans it becomes something that is a big boost to the broadcast experience, and I hope it raises the bar for everybody. I like the people NBC and Amazon both hired. We'll see how it all works out though. Long year ahead, and we need those monologues. I mean, we need them. We need them. They can put them on social nowadays too. Put them everywhere before every game.
I texted No Eagles. I'll write them for you, man. Like, just make sure it's in there.
I mean, he's got the voice. You get the mind for it. Amin, appreciate you joining me today, man. Have a good one.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, a big thank you to Amin. He mentioned Sunday Night Football. Up next, we're going to be talking about Drake May, superstar Patriots quarterback. The Patriots are back with Warren Sharp after their big win against the Bills, and my other 6 points from this week in the NFL. And I want to remind you as well, before we bring on Warren, I'm doing a mailbag episode on Thursday on the podcast. So leave a comment and Spotify's comments below. If you're listening there, hit me up on social or email me at kocshow@yahoosports.com, and we'll answer that on Thursday. All right, time for 6 points and to talk about week 5 in the NFL. Warren Sharp from sharpfootballanalysis.com. Warren, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Exciting week 5 in the rearview mirrors. Monday Night Football on tap, of course. And always happy to talk about ball with you guys, and looking forward to breaking down some of the week 5 results here.
We're going to start off with Sunday Night Football. My Patriots won in Buffalo against the Bills 23-20. And boy, oh boy, all my doubts about Drake May have just been disappeared after last night's game. 22 of 30 in the game, 273 yards in the second half. Just absolute perfection. 13 of 14 in the second half, made every single play he had to make. The stiff arm pass to Diggs, Warren, he made. And then the play after that, the sideline throw to Booty. I mean, he did everything he had to do. He looked like a superstar, answered all of my concerns about him. Is Drake May the next superstar NFL quarterback, Warren? Because it sure looked like it last night.
I think he put on a great show. I don't know that I'm willing to put him in the superstar category. No, don't mean to burst your bubble, but I do think he had a great performance that obviously helped the Patriots pull off a massive upset. I think there are a lot of factors with that, though. They couldn't really run the football, so that was even more positivity towards Drake May. I don't understand what Mike Vrabel was still doing, putting Ramondre Stevenson in the backfield. Maybe you can explain that to me, Kevin, because I mean, he is a massive liability still in my mind. And it was like at the end of the game when the Patriots had marched the ball back down the field and were getting ready to, you know, kick the game-winning field goal, they hand the ball off to Ramondre. And I'm thinking to myself, the only way you lose this game is by handing the ball off to Ramondre at this point in time because he could fumble it. Then, of course, they hand the ball off to Ramondre. And it was like, Mike Vrabel, what are you doing here? But Drake was outstanding. And that one play where he was able to almost was down on his knee, had his shoulder pad being pulled down, and still was able to get the ball out was what, you know, leads to the legends. That's one of those plays that people are going to look back on, and it's one of the reasons they won this game, one of the reasons why he had a great step forward in his second season. I am now, though, thinking, Kevin, that the coaching in New England has exceeded the coaching in Buffalo. And I still think the best player on the field is Josh Allen, but I think the coaching staff is far superior in New England to what we have in Buffalo. And case in point, you were watching the game, I was watching the game. How many times did Drake May scramble to his right before throwing any meaningful pass in that game? It was like 90% of the time it felt like before any big pass, he's scrambling to the right. And the Bills still had absolutely no way to stop.
One scramble left, right? The one that got tipped, right? The one scramble left, I think, yeah, that's the only one I have in my mind.
Yeah, it was remarkable how infrequently he was moving to the left or staying in the pocket. I love what Josh McDaniels is building there for him in year two for Drake May. I think that's a massive improvement. They use a lot of heavy personnel. Their efficiency passing the ball out of 12 personnel is absolutely phenomenal. So just kudos all around the board. I mean, the coaching staff, the play calling, Drake's execution, they didn't lose the game. They didn't cost the game themselves. And I don't know what Josh Allen exactly was doing on some of his dropbacks. I don't really understand. The other thing is when we talk about coaching, yes, the Buffalo Bills don't have like an alpha number one wide receiver, right? Stephon Diggs is now in New England, but they don't have a number one alpha, but they constantly are rotating their receivers in and out of the game. So much so that like it's hard to build a solid rapport with the top guys. And it always feels like Buffalo is like lacking something. I mean, yes, they scored 30 points most every game, but like to build a championship team, you have to be bulletproof, especially with your defense like this. Sean McDermott's defense always lets them down and let them down again in this game. They couldn't stop Drake May and that passing attack for the New England Patriots. That defense, a lot of money was funneled into it. What if they can't win the ball on defense, they have to be bulletproof on offense. And I don't think you can be bulletproof when you're rotating in so many different receivers. Like build a rapport with your top guys. When one of them gets tired, bring in another guy, but they rotate their guys in far too often. And it's shocking to me. People are talking about, oh yeah, Mike McDaniel might get fired down in Miami. Let's bring in Joe Brady as the head coach. I just don't think Joe Brady is anywhere qualified yet. I have not seen it. He's attached at the hip to Josh Allen, and Josh Allen is making Joe Brady, not the other way around.
So the Bills are 4-1. Obviously, they're the only undefeated going into last night's game before losing to the Patriots. And you know, New England plays a great game. And like I feel like this team, since their week one loss, when Drake, that was his worst game of the season, he's been significantly better ever since then. And you know, talk about that in a second. But regarding the Bills, Warren, they're 4-1, and a lot of people would consider them, especially with the Chiefs off to an up and down start, the Ravens off to a horrible start. A lot of people would say they are the favorite in the AFC. Do you think that they are the Super Bowl favorite in the AFC, or are you still going in a different direction at this point?
No, I still think they are because I still think their schedule is so easy that they'll win enough games to have the number one seed, and having the number one seed is absolutely massive when you're talking about only one team gets a bye. So as a result, I definitely do think that the Buffalo Bills should be favored in the AFC. The issue, though, is just like, are they the best team in the AFC? I still think the answer is probably yes. But what's frustrating to me is I just feel like they're wasting Josh Allen. Like, that's the sad part about it is I watch, and I know this could be viewed as like overreaction, but I just watch this team play too many of these big games, and it's either Josh Allen making a critical mistake or because he's trying to do too much, but it feels like they don't have the rest of the system around them built up quite as much to be as bulletproof as I think that they need to be to, for me to say, yeah, like, I feel good about putting my money on them to win it all. Like, I think they should be favored. Doesn't mean I'm betting them to win it.
I think that's fair with the Bills. And I mean, you had a little bit of a slip there by accident saying the Patriots being the Super Bowl favorite. Maybe these are old habits coming back. Maybe that's what we're seeing happen right now, Warren. Because I'll tell you what, with Drake May, I had my questions pre-draft. I had my questions keeping an eye on the Patriots last year. I had my questions during week one, throwing myself back into the NFL this year. And with Drake May, I tweeted during week one, Drake May is not the guy. In an emotional, disappointed state where it felt like the Patriots were doing the same things that they were doing last year, same mistakes, same problems. Mike Vrabel replacing Gerard Mayo during week one, I said that. And I was wrong. It's already worthy of being on Old Takes Exposed. Yesterday, I deleted it and I tweeted this out instead as a sign that I have made a mistake, and you can use that screenshot forever as probably my second worst take besides Killian Hayes being the number one pick in the 2021 NBA draft. So this is my second worst take all time was Drake May is not the guy. He is indeed the guy I thought he showed against the Bills and has showed really ever since week one with his week-to-week improvement. Collinsworth mentioned, you know, a couple things he wanted to see Drake May improve at over the course of the season. And you did say initially that you're not quite there with saying he's a superstar or the next superstar. What are the things you do want to see Drake May continue to get better at in order to become that next great quarterback in the NFL?
I think pocket presence is one thing. I mean, you got to have to deal with the pass rush a little bit better. Knowing when and how to scramble. Running quarterbacks, mobile quarterbacks, are one of the hacks in the NFL. But the key is figuring out the right times to scramble. Even some of the best, like Josh Allen, take for example. I was tweeting about this earlier today, and it kind of got picked up on by a lot of the people in Buffalo echoing these sort of sentiments. There was a play on their final drive on third down where they ended up settling for the field goal to tie the game at 20 apiece, where Josh Allen, in a clean pocket, decided to shift to his right, move out of the clean pocket. Ultimately, he throws the ball back across his body, I think targeting Khalil Shakir. Pass was defensed by Gonzalez and knocked away, and then they had to settle for a field goal. He has a wide open receiver if he just stays in the pocket, running a corner out to the left, and could easily hit it to this guy, and it would have been a touchdown, and the Bills would have had the lead, but he moved out of the pocket. The announcers last night didn't pick up on that, but the announcers constantly were praising Josh Allen earlier in the game and criticizing Drake May for keeping Josh Allen's eyes down the field in spite of the rush, being able to move around and still throw the ball down the field. But in this case, he left the pocket too soon. This is something like Josh Allen, some of the local people were talking about it. I agreed with this. At times, he feels like he has to do so much for the team that he ends up, and I tweeted out this link, this quote that I think is very appropriate. It was apparently Drew Brees told this to Jameis Winston. I'm not sure if you've heard this one, Kevin. Be Bruce Wayne until you have to be Batman. You don't need to be Batman all the time. And that's like very appropriate for Josh Allen. Is like sometimes you do need to trust what's there, stay in the pocket. But when he gets late in games and he feels like he has to run and turn it on and everything like that, then he's like always in that mindset instead of reading out the defense every single snap and running when it's appropriate. That's what Drake May needs to build up as well. Not the Batman aspect of it, but you know, run when there's a lane there. Run when you can take advantage of it. I've told this to coaches that I've worked with in the past, and this was true 5 years ago and is true today. The number one best play in football is when a quarterback sees an open run lane in front of him and just takes it. just a design pass play where a quarterback just runs with an open run lane in front of him. That is like guaranteed to get like 5 to 7 yards per play at a minimum, 5 to 7 yards per play. When he sees it, take it. So many of these quarterbacks are being coached to like read things out, look down the field. And yes, absolutely. You should try to be doing that and win the down before the snap even occurs by being intelligent enough to get your team into the right play based upon the coverage. This is what Tom Brady always did. He talks about it at length, you know, in the offseason on some of the shows that he's done. Win the down before the snap, get the team in the right position, make sure, like, I think he had a quote, "I never judge myself based on the throw that I made. I judge myself based upon, were we in the right play for the defense so that we could win this snap?" And that's what all quarterbacks need to focus a lot more on. And so, yes, if you can like figure out that play and know where to throw the ball, that's what you should be doing. But certain situations, when there's an open run, like just take it. It's a layup. You know, this basketball, like super easy. Don't pass up the layup. Don't pass up that layup. Get those. Generally speaking, those plays average actually closer to 9 yards. I gave the bare minimum of 5 to 7, but it's an average. You would take a 9 yard average play any day of the week. And so you need to take that more frequently. So run when there's that opportunity. Don't feel like you have to be a pure pocket passer and sit in the pocket. But I think he's well on his way. And I think with his coaching staff, he's going to get there. I really do think that the scheme that they've got there is a winning scheme. And I love the personnel that they have to support that, especially with Diggs not seeming to be bringing his like ego with him and just buying into the team concept with Vrabel there. I mean, it's I love what I'm seeing so far. They could just figure out the fumbles. I'm not sure what's going on with Ramondre Stevenson, but I would love to see a little bit more Travion Henderson personally, but I really like what this team is doing, and they're really good against the run as well. So once Gonzalez is back, like fully healthy in the secondary, this is a very well-rounded team.
A lot of easy games on the Patriots schedule as well. So a lot potentially, yes. A lot of wins ahead from, they could very well be 7-2, 8-2 at one point. So you mentioned, you know, the quarterback development, and one of the things that's, you know, been on my mind this season, and then before the season began, I'm getting back into the league, and I'm asking about, you know, is Baker Mayfield good now? Like, what, you know, Geno Smith going to the Raiders, like these guys who, you know, really weren't that good the last time I was really watching the NFL super closely. Like Josh Allen become a megastar, Lamar Jackson having only 4 interceptions last year, and again this season interception totals seem to be quite low. So I'm curious, Warren, can you explain to me what are the factors behind the low interception totals across the NFL?
It's even though we've had Cooper Rush throwing 3 yesterday, backup obviously in a bad situation getting his butt kicked, even though Jake Browning threw 3, another backup getting his butt kicked, we are still at the fewest total interceptions thrown in any season through week 5 since, wow, at least 2000, where my numbers go back to. So we aren't seeing nearly as many interceptions. It's in part because teams are not trying to press the two high safeties. They're trying to just throw underneath. They're taking what the defense is giving them a little bit more. They're also running the football at a little bit higher rate in general across the league, although we should talk about the Philadelphia Eagles and their lack of running the football with a massive lead yesterday. But the point is that we're not seeing nearly as many interceptions league-wide. And that is why the punch-out fumbles are becoming more of a game-changing factor. Because normally it would be interceptions. Like any turnover, any takeaway is a game-changing factor. But now that we have teams that are more focused on hunting out the punch-out on tackles, and you see it all the time, the punch-outs and how they work, you rarely see the times, though, like unless you're focused on it, where guys are just, you know, solid wrap up on a defender, and they could easily be trying to go after the ball. And this is something that's coached, and some teams have tried to work on it more. Monday Night Football, the Jacksonville Jaguars have been really good at this. Let's see if they focus on it, although the Kansas City Chiefs are really good with protecting the football and coaching that as well. So there's two sides to every coin. But those punch outs were massive. I think that there were who lost it on Thursday Night Football. The Rams lost it at the goal line. Kyren Williams had it punched out heading into the end zone. That lost the game for the Rams, 100%, just lost the game for them there. And we've seen that around the league. Cam Scadaboo had it punched out yesterday. That was a big factor because that then was returned for a touchdown in the Saints beating the New York Giants in that game. And there were a couple of other games where punch outs had a massive turning point in those games. So punch outs and coaching up those punch outs. And I had a stat last week. It's not updated through this week, but if you had more fumbles forced than your opponent, as long as you didn't throw more interceptions than them, like if the interception numbers were at least neutral, you were 22-2 on the season. So like forcing these fumbles and getting punch outs is the new way to help yourself win games in 2025.
I mean, it gets back to your point about Ramondre Stevenson handing the ball after his fumble early in the game. It's like the only way you could lose this game if it's punched out Kyren Williams style on Thursday Night Football. And so continuing to go to him, you know, A, it displays trust in a guy who's had some good games in his career, some success, and you're trying to coach him through it, and maybe he can become better and solve this fumble-itis that he has. But at the same time, you're putting your team at risk of losing the game, considering the frequency in which defenders are trying to punch out the ball, probably more than ever at this point. And they're doing that, I guess you're saying, as a byproduct of the fact quarterbacks aren't throwing as many interceptions. So this is a reaction to quarterbacks not turning the ball over as much themselves, right?
Right. If you're a defense and you want to coach up, we need to be ball hawks. We need to figure out ways to get takeaways to help our team win games. If you can't get as many interceptions, then you've got to go the alternate direction and go for those fumbles. And when you have running backs, because now the run rate is a little bit higher, and so the running backs are running through the line of scrimmage and there's more players around them when they're being tackled. Think about it. Like if you're throwing a pass to Stephon Diggs on the sidelines, or all those passes that Drake May was scrambling to his right and throwing it down the sideline, guy was catching it toe tap style on the sideline, you can't force a fumble on those plays. They're very hard to intercept as well. But if we're just relying on the fumble aspect of it, on pass plays and catches, it's harder to force fumbles. There's fewer defenders around those players. But when we're talking about on run plays, when there's multiple guys swarming to try to tackle somebody on most plays that a running back is tackled, like that's where you need to be trying to force those fumbles out a lot more frequently, attacking and hunting the ball. And the smartest teams and the smartest defensive coordinators are coaching that more. And I tweeted out about this last week with some of the data to support it. And some people are like, oh, this has been going on for years, the peanut punch. I obviously know about the peanut punch. I'm not suggesting that nobody ever punched the ball out until 2025. I'm saying that more teams around the league are absolutely keying in on this factor as a way to turn games, since takeaways via interception are down, and they're coaching it up league-wide for their players to try to punch the ball out more frequently. And that's why we've seen punch outs at a ridiculously high rate through 5 weeks.
All right, third point here, Warren. Eagles lost to the Broncos 21-17. Broncos scored 18 straight in the fourth quarter. Sean Payton, just massive cojones, going for two, going to go up 18-17. They end up winning back by 4 points. And so the Eagles, they go up 17-3 with a second half opening drive touchdown. And then after that, 5 plays, 23 yards, punt. 3 plays, minus 16 yards, punt. 3 plays, minus 6 yards, punt. 3 plays, 2 yards, punt. 6 plays, 45 yards, time runs out, end of the game, they lose, undefeated, no longer. What's going on with this Eagles offense? What was that second half game plan, man?
I don't know what their game plan in general has been. For Saquon Barkley to have 6 runs, here's the mind-boggling thing. I mean, this team, to your point, like they were up by a large margin. We had however many points you said unanswered that the Broncos scored. The Eagles are in a commanding lead in this game through and into the fourth quarter. And guess which team of all the games in week 5 had the number one highest pass rate on Sunday? It's the Eagles.
The Eagles?
Well, really? How do you have, wow. They passed the ball on 81% of their plays in the course of the game. We're not talking about like just the last drive where they were trying to like come back and win because they were losing. Like they were up by a big margin the entire game and passed the ball on 81% of their plays, the highest pass rate of any team. Saquon Barkley had 6 rushing attempts. I do not understand what this offensive coordinator is doing. I don't understand to a degree what Jeffrey Lurie was signing up for here. They saw their team lose play callers back a couple of years ago and promote from in-house to replace them. And it was a disaster. And they went out mercenary style last year and got play callers from other teams and brought them in, they won a Super Bowl. And here, once again, they lose their offense coordinator, Kellen Moore. He goes down to New Orleans, and we are replacing by a promotion in-house, and it's been an epic failure. I mean, they've had some injuries along the offensive line, but they cannot run the football efficiently. Their dropback game seems broken and predictable. They don't really seem like they are they have a focus of what they're trying to accomplish. You're just calling plays. It doesn't really feel like they're setting up the offense, building the offense. I mean, AJ Brown complains about targets and all of a sudden they're just throwing the ball down the field a lot the very next game and not running it. This game, my guess, my prediction for week six is an overcorrection to the run game. I think Saquon Barkley ran the ball six times. We had a lead in the fourth quarter. We had the highest pass rate. What are we doing? Looking themselves in the mirror in their facility today, like being very disappointed. And now they're going to overcorrect and run the ball a ton. I mean,
this week with the 81% yes. pass rate. And so like they were trying exactly. to appease the receivers this week. And next week it's like, oh, well, we went too far that way. Now we're going to go swing back the other way. Like you're not seeing a balance. That this team needs. Was it like not enough passing in the first 4 weeks and then this week was too much that they haven't found that middle ground?
Well, it's one thing to pass to build a lead, but you have to get a run game going. And I also didn't necessarily like the way that they were building the pass game this past week, but it's so predictable. Like it was easy for me to bet this game. You know, I obviously bet on these games. It was easy for me to bet this game. I took the Denver Broncos, but I also took from a props perspective, I bet Saquon Barkley under 80 and a half rushing yards. I took him over his receiving yards at like 16 and a half, something like that. Laddered that up because the Broncos are the worst defense in the NFL against running back passes. He caught that long bomb touchdown pass, like a 50-yard touchdown pass. So all those ladders hit for Saquon Barkley. It was just very easy to predict what this offense was going to do in this game. I agree. It was an overcorrection last week, and now we're going to get an overcorrection the other direction this upcoming week is my prediction. I think they're going to run the ball a ton. I don't know if it's going to be successful. So I don't mind leaning into the pass. Like, I'm not coming on here promoting hand the ball off to running backs all game long, right? I don't believe in that. I have a modern philosophy as it comes to passing the football. But there has to be aspects of balance. And if the defense is playing the pass and slowing the pass down by dropping back, you have to be able to run the ball. Or if you have the lead, you have to be able to be efficient on the ground, calling some run plays. And you will not know what is working on the ground if your number one running back has six carries the entire game. Six carries for Saquon Barkley the entire game with a lead like that. It's just not a good strategy. It's not optimal.
It's insane. And just for reference, prior to this week, Saquon had 18, 22, 18, and 19 carries. Falls all the way down to six, despite having a 17-3 lead heading into the fourth quarter. That is nuts. Just absolutely crazy. So Eagles have some things to figure out. The Ravens, they absolutely have a lot to figure out. Fourth point here. Ravens are 1-4. They get the Rams on Sunday. Is it time to bury the Baltimore Ravens as a Super Bowl contender?
Man, I don't want to have this conversation, Kevin, because I just like Lamar Jackson so much as a talent, as a quarterback. I think so many people have piled on to the wrong things when it comes to Lamar. He hasn't been able to win the big one. He hasn't been able to get over the hump. So they're just assumed that he's just not a good quarterback, right? Like, oh, well, he's terrible in the clutch, so he's not a good quarterback. Like, you know the way it is. Everybody is just so provocative in one way or the other, and there's no nuanced conversations that can be had out there anymore. So that's the frustrating part of this for me. I don't know what this team is, though, right now. I truly don't. The Houston Texans clearly were able to name their score, and they clearly decided we're not taking the foot off the gas pedal. And credit to them. You know, like, they got embarrassed by the Baltimore Ravens a couple of times. Once in the postseason, they got embarrassed on Christmas. What was it, last year or the year before? I mean, the Ravens have had their number. And so they came out and really tried to make their offense everybody happy, right? Get the quarterback feeling good, get the run game feel good, get the receivers feeling good, like good vibes all the way around, make their keep their defense feeling good. So credit to D'Amico Ryans and company for coming in there and laying an absolute beatdown on the Baltimore Ravens. I did think it was funny, Kevin. I saw a clip today about a guy on the Texans was trying to do like the Ray Lewis dance, and then the Ravens came out and like one of the players, I think it was Alexander, comes out, the DB, and shoves him. It's like, no, you're not doing that in our house. It's like, buddy, you're getting your butt. Like, if you cared about our house, defending our house, where was that effort the whole rest of the game? We're caring about a celebration at this point. Like, I just felt like that was short-sighted behavior there. But whatever. I just feel like this defense is a problem, and that's not going to be corrected. They are going to get players back on both sides of the football. They are not going to look this bad, obviously. And it's beyond Lamar. Like, there's a lot of players that are injured for this team. Their starting nose tackle, Madubuike, is out for the entire season, though. And so teams are going to be able to run the football on the Ravens. And when you can run the football on the Ravens, the way the Ravens are going to have success, the only way is to get out to such big leads that defenses have to just turn to the offenses have to turn to the pass on you. They just have to throw the football. I don't know if they're going to be capable of doing that, because this is not like an aerial. They could score points with almost anybody, usually with Lamar up, but their offensive line is having some injuries. They don't have those stud receivers. Lamar never really has had stud receivers, so they build through the ground game and then passing off of that. I'm not ready to bury this team. I think down the stretch, they're going to be competitive and they can sneak into the playoffs, and they're going to be a team that nobody would want to face in the postseason, despite Lamar's previous struggles. But I do think as long as Lamar is not injured, they have a bye after this game for a longer period of time. I think that they're competitive, and I still look at that AFC North and say, what is this division? Yeah. I mean, I'm not necessarily buying the Pittsburgh Steelers. Then you look at the Bengals, not good. The Browns, not great. At least they have one side of the football that they're really good on, which is their defense. So I still think the Ravens can get into the postseason here, even with this start. And I buy into like their coaching staff in general of motivating the team as long as Lamar is healthy. The issue, though, like why, Kevin, explain to me why they had Derrick Henry in the game down like 38-6 or whatever the score was in the fourth quarter, running between the tackles for 2 yards a carry. What are we doing? What point are we proving here? Why is Derrick Henry, who is old, who has a could get injured, who you're going to need healthy when you do try to win games, and you have no shot of winning this one, even involved in this game? I don't understand it. So that was something, although I, in general, think the coaching staff uses analytics and is a smarter coaching staff than average. That was a decision was mind-boggling to me.
Yeah,
not that it lost the game or anything, but just unnecessary.
Of course, just a silly, short-sighted decision with no reason for it. And ultimately, I think with the Ravens, I agree with you. You know, Steelers at 3-1, Bengals at 2-3, and then the Browns and Ravens both at 1-4. They still could even win the division. Yeah, right. They really could still win the AFC North at this point, despite this horrible start. It provided Lamar is able to return and stay healthy, and that hammy doesn't linger as an issue throughout the entire season. Like, of course, provided Lamar can stay healthy. But as you said, if he misses week six and then has the bye, and he's got 3 weeks essentially to rest and recover from that, hopefully for Baltimore, they're able to get Lamar back, and hopefully they're able to also, you know, keep Derrick Henry fresh as well. But I'm with you, Warren. Ravens
are going to lose this week, though. I wouldn't bury him, but like the LA Rams are 7.5-point road favorites, and we just saw the Houston Texans come in here with that like abysmal, disorganized offense and basically name the score. The Ravens, they might get a couple of guys back, but I don't think they're getting everybody back defensively. They're about to head into bye week where they could rest some players. They're still playing with Cooper Rush 100% this week. The Rams could come in here and name their score themselves, even though they're only favored by 7.5 points here. So the Ravens are going to be sitting at 1-5 on the other side of the bye week, trying to figure out a way to maybe they're in the grave, like the dirt hasn't been put over them yet. They're going to have to figure a way to climb out of the grave. And avoid being absolutely buried.
maybe this is the way it has to be for them to get over the top in the postseason. You have to start low. The crash landing, instead of it happening in January, happens in October. And then you get out of that and you dig your way out of it. And this is the year they end up winning it all. We'll see. As you said, it's going to be tough for them after likely 1-5 after next week. Moving on to a team that's 0-5 and really no hope, it seems, of winning games. Just the New York Jets. They are 0-5 on the season now after a disastrous Sunday loss. Justin Fields, I saw a stat posted online that he's now 0-26 as a starter when the opponent scores just 21 points or more in his NFL career. And I feel like with this Jets team, even besides the game itself, the quote he had last week about, you know, we're highly paid professionals, we're fortunate to get paid, you know, to play a child sport when they're 0-4. To me, that was a sign of a guy who is not going to be a winner at the highest levels in the NBA. Like, save that for LeBron after he loses a championship, when he says you're going to wake up the next day and you have the same life, but I'm still happy. Let legends like LeBron say that. But Justin Fields, come on, man. What is this? That's not the right approach or mindset to have. This team seems hopeless with him and Glenn as head coach, man.
Yeah, and I wrote about that stat in my book. It was a few losses less. I want to say it was like 0-23 at the time. But people, when I tweeted that stat out last week when it was 0-25, people were like defending Justin. Oh, well, it's the defense, it's the other things. It's like, at some point, you can't just keep pointing your fingers at everybody else. At some point, you have to realize what is going on here. And Justin Fields has a little bit of Bryce Young to him in that they don't start off games very fast. The one game that he started off relatively well was against the Pittsburgh Steelers. But for the most part, he's starting off games badly. And when you start off games badly, I mean, yeah, you could look at the final score. Oh, 37-22. The Jets were a little bit competitive. No, they weren't. They were down 30-3 in this game. You know, they're scoring garbage time points, just like what happened with Bryce Young down in Carolina, where he scored enough garbage time points to come back, but they were down 17-0. I mean, they at least came back to win that game. But the other thing is, I'm looking at Aaron Glenn, and he's standing there on the sidelines, and I forget what sitcom this is. Oh, this is the movie, right? I think it's Office Space. It says, what is it you say you do here? Like, Aaron Glenn is just standing on the sideline. They keep panning to him because he's getting his butt kicked, like 30-3, and he's just standing there, doing nothing, saying nothing into his headset, just looking at the game unfold in front of him. And the question becomes, like, are you trying to coach up anybody? Are you making adjustments anywhere? Are you trying to motivate anybody? Are you just watching this unfold, letting your coordinators handle it, and you're just standing there doing nothing and trying to be absolved from what else is happening because you're not calling the plays? I don't understand.
No, my coordinator does that. That's the quote I get off of. No, my secretary does that. My coordinator does that.
Right. I don't understand. I did not understand what he was doing, and they kept showing him because of the loss. We knew this going in, though. Justin Fields, this was not a good situation. I was just a little surprised, I will say, in this game, for what I perceived to be like a lack of desire. And it's hard to really measure that, but I'm just watching this game, and I had the over, which ended up winning. But I'm watching this game, and I'm seeing, like, he's sliding on runs. He's taking it easy at times. And it's like, you're 0-4. You lost in embarrassing fashion on primetime on Monday night. You're coming home against the Dallas Cowboys. The Dallas Cowboys are down 4 starting offensive linemen. They're down their number one receiver. And their defense was never that great to begin with. And this is the effort that you present in a home game after an embarrassing loss on primetime TV. That just speaks volumes to me about the direction that this team is headed. I didn't think it was going to be a good team going in, but I don't really know how they get things back on track here, given the effort that I saw, the personnel that they have there, and the quarterback who is leading them.
0.6 here, Warren. Titans, 16 unanswered points, and probably the weirdest comeback win. I mean, like, have you ever seen an interception to fumble to touchdown before? I would not watch this game live at all. I had it, you know, I had a one screen on Red Zone, and then I saw the NFL posted the full 18-minute video on YouTube. So I watched that this morning, and I don't think I've ever seen a comeback like this one. It's just weird. The Cardinals did everything they could to give the game away. Every single point of that game. Have you seen a weirder comeback than this one?
Have not. I mean, especially after we saw last week, A.D. Mitchell do the thing that Jonathan Taylor from a few years ago of dropping the ball before he crosses the end zone. How do you allow that to happen again? And Jonathan Gannon rightfully screamed in his face on the sideline. I saw that clip, just very animated. But like, to me, that's coaching, right? That's coaching.
I agree.
You show your team what happened to A.D. Mitchell the prior week and say, if you score a touchdown and you don't run and hand the ball to the ref, or you don't do a celebration in the back of the end zone, like you take the ball through the end zone, the front of the end zone, into the back of the end zone, and then you come back into the end zone if you want to celebrate with your team, but you hit the back of the end zone before you do anything with the football. And to not establish that as like, this is what our team is going to be doing, and we're not going to be on all the SportsCenter blooper things at any point during the season for having something like this happen. And then the very next week that happens, that to me is coaching. Because players have all sorts of things in their minds, but you as the coach have to manage what you want the product to look like out on the field with the players that you are coaching. So I thought that was a disaster. And then that interception where they then turned into a touchdown by Tyler Lockett was probably the most remarkable thing I have ever seen. I can't remember. I'm sure there have been weirder plays that I've seen at different points in time. Of course, you've got like miracle plays with like the Tennessee miracle when they scored a touchdown on the side lateral on the return. Like there are some bigger momentous plays that have won games for teams that happen in unbelievable fashion. But like where a guy has the ball and then it turns into a touchdown a second later, that is just a head scratcher. And so many people were knocked out of Survivor by the Arizona Cardinals in that game, because a lot of the big teams that were favored this past week to win games ended up losing outright. You got the Buffalo Bills on Sunday Night Football. You have the Rams on Thursday Night Football, who were big favorites against all the backups for the 49ers. They lost outright. And then you had the Arizona Cardinals, who were 7.5-point favorites against a winless, hapless, poorly coached Tennessee Titans team. And then they lost. And they would have gone up, 28-3, I think, before he fumbles that football. It was just one of the most mind-boggling wins that I can imagine in my most recent memory.
28-3. I love those two numbers together. Good memories there. Talk about comebacks.
You as a Pats fan. Yes.
Yes, exactly. For me as a Patriots fan, that's for sure. Cam Ward made some plays down the stretch of that game, some great passes, especially to Ridley, who kind of revived after having some tough matchups early in the week. I'm hopeful for Ridley for my fantasy team. Let's go for two with our 6 points here. And I have two more questions for you, Warren. Number seven. Any reason for the Vikings to stick with Carson Wentz here? Game-winning drive, bye week coming up. J.J. McCarthy, I think, nearing health to return. It seems like the Vikings have a decision. Is there any reason for the Vikings to stick with Carson Wentz?
It really depends on what their goals are. I mean, are your goals to win a few more games this season and see what you could do with the rest of your roster? Then you go with Wentz, because Wentz provides a higher floor. But you know what Wentz is. Like, you know what Wentz is. I don't think 2020, I love this coaching staff. I don't know that 2025 Carson Wentz is winning a Super Bowl, though. Like, I just don't know if that's happening. So if you're in the building and you don't think that's happening, you got to figure out what your young quarterback is. And he didn't get a chance at all to play his rookie season. And so you have to throw him out there and let him work through some of the drawbacks and go into film study and review them and go over them and correct some things and then get back out there and try to improve a little bit more. Not everybody, every quarterback's first year was a successful season. A lot of these first years have been struggles, and then they come back and end up performing well. Statistically, there's a quarterback like a Bryce Young. I mentioned him before, but Bryce Young, statistically, based upon his first two seasons, like, he falls in a category for me, based on my research, that he will never be a franchise quarterback. Like, you throw him into all the guys that are going to be backups for some period of time, but statistically, he is not the type of quarterback who would jump. Now, it's not 100%. Like nothing is 100%. He could always be the one in a million that does something, but I'm just going with the percentages. He is not. You don't know what you've got in JJ McCarthy yet. You just don't know. It's too small of a sample size. You got to get him out there to work a little bit more and to figure out ways to win and change and adjust your coaching strategy so that you can get them, put him in the best positions possible to succeed. Because we've seen that he's not going to succeed when he's put into some bad situations. So figure out ways to get him into better situations. And it's going to take more work for the coaching staff. It's not going to be as easy for the coaching staff to try to win games with him in there. But without seeing what he does, without giving him the games, you're never going to know. And then what'd you do with the draft pick? So I think you got to put him back out there for sure. Do you sit on the other side of the table or?
No, I'm with you, man. I mean, I think with JJ McCarthy, his week one, that fourth quarter comeback, the team clearly rallied behind him. That there's clearly something there that they believe in. And I think for the Vikings, as you said, Carson Wentz probably doesn't raise your ceiling enough this year. JJ McCarthy, maybe he lowers your floor, but he does give you that kind of X factor chance of a higher ceiling this season, as well as giving you information that is extremely necessary considering the investment that you made and finding out what he's going to be in the long term. So to me, I think JJ McCarthy both lowers the floor and raises the ceiling this year, but also gives you very, very vital long-term information throughout the course of the season. So yeah, to me, it's like a no-brainer. They should go with JJ McCarthy. I would not go with Carson Wentz. You know who he is. Let's move on to the last point here. Number eight, Chiefs. They're 3.5-point favorites on the Jaguars over the Jaguars on Monday Night Football. What's the key to a Jaguars upset, Warren?
You got to keep Trevor Lawrence on schedule. He's got to be able to complete these early down passes so that you're not playing behind the sticks. Trevor Lawrence has massive splits with and without pressure. We know Steve Spagnuolo's defense is a very tricky one to have success against, especially if it's third down, especially if you're in a predictable situation. So the key factor here is keeping Trevor Lawrence ahead of schedule on early downs, balancing the run, the pass, making sure that you're gaining enough yards on those early downs. And that's where Liam Cohen comes into play, designing a very sound offensive strategy to utilize against this defense that is not as good as we've seen in years past, but still has a very good coaching staff that is very good in single game situations. And they're going to try to make life hell for Trevor Lawrence. And the Jacksonville Jaguars and that coaching staff and Liam Cohen have to figure out ways to not let that influence the outcome of this game.
I look forward to that one tonight, Warren. Appreciate you joining me today to recap everything else that we saw this week in the NFL. Please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
Yeah, over at sharpfootballanalysis.com. And actually, we've got a special this week. I want to say I got a little sheet here. If you go to sharp.football, you can get any betting / fantasy package for just $1 if you use the code Kevin when you check out. So we do a lot of fantasy football over there, a lot of betting, a lot of player props are having a really good season. So make sure you guys check that out. Just go to sharp.football and that's the way to find us.
Code Kevin. Appreciate it, Warren. Thank you so much for giving my listeners a discount on your site. I'll have to check that out as well, man, because my fantasy team needs some help. I need some assistance.
Well, my kids just got into fantasy football this year as their first year. And my son's team is kicking butt and my daughter's team, not so much. So I mean, fantasy football, I used to be into fantasy football back in the day. It does take up a lot of time though, if you're trying to actually win and do well. And I just started to focus all my time in other directions that are a lot more profitable. So
I know it's like my friend league. Unfortunately, I don't know why we haven't raised the price yet. A $50 buy-in. It's like a full-time job for a $600 reward. I mean, what am I doing with my time?
Yeah. Yeah, same. It was like I wanted to stay with the friends that I was doing this with since college, but it just wasn't like worth the effort anymore. And as a result, yes, you have lost communication with some of those individuals, but I just couldn't devote the time to this to try to like actually care about it.
I'm making an effort to turn it off a little bit. You know, I'm trying my best to tune it down. It's just hard. I'm a competitor, man. I want to win. I definitely want to beat my friends' asses. But you know,
well, that's where like betting and fantasy football and DFS and all these other things have grown, and they're so much more fun to play. They've got a more instant gratification because you just submit a lineup on Sunday morning and you see if you've won. You place a prop bet and you know in a few hours if you got paid for it. And so there's so much more instant gratification with things like that in the props and the DFS for sure. side of things than investing like a season-long fantasy football league. So that's a young man's game, Kevin. It's the young people. Like they love doing that, but you and I, people our age, you know, I know a lot of people that got into best ball too. Best ball is a little bit easier. You just like draft. It's all about drafting, and then you don't do anything during the season. But having like season long fantasy teams, more power to you if you can pull that off.
I'm gonna be 1-4 with like the second or third most points in my league. It's just a
it's frustrating. Like how do you what do you do? Awful. Yeah, you, it's not even your fault.
Awful.
You're a good manager, and yet you can't even do. You can't even win games. You got the same record as the Tennessee Titans. Think about that, Kevin. You've got the same record as the Tennessee Titans right now.
I love it though. It's still so fun to play. I love the bickering and the competition and the trade talks with my friends. I love getting ghosted when I try to go for good players and then they go off on their bench. That beats me. I have a lot of fun with it. Warren, people can use just code Kevin at sharpfootballanalysis.com. Thank you so much for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Big thank you to Amin and Warren for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and TJ for producing today's episode. We'll be back again later in the week with my mailbag episode. My mailbag episode coming out. So if you're listening on Spotify, leave a comment with your takes, your thoughts, your questions, whatever it might be, and I'll find that and we'll use it on the show. Or at me on social, at Kevin O'Connor on X, Instagram, TikTok, Threads. Send it anywhere and I'll find it. Or you can email me at kocshow@yahoosports.com. Looking forward to that episode. Have a good week, everybody. Talk to you soon.